I think it's March 31, isn't it? Well past the Ides of March. Beware of the Ides of March. And we're now dealing with page number 9 in the Serotonin chapter. And we're looking at melatonin and so on. I went through this carefully, and I'll get to a point where I got stuck, and I'll tell you a little story, and then we'll go on. Now, I think we stopped with melatonin, didn't we? We talked about satiety. Anyway, it's not sat. It's something satiety. It's interesting. And then we talked about how the receptors deal with some of this stuff. You don't need to know much about the postsynaptic receptors, et cetera, that on there. Postsynaptic 5-HTB1, don't worry about that. It will. It's not relevant. And we have to take a look at melatonin. Melatonin. That didn't help at all. This is how your circadian rhythm keeps on track. And that is because there is an eye input. If you don't get it, I'll pick it up. Get you one later. There is an eye relationship. Your eye and mechanisms deep within the base of your brain help control your circadian rhythm, your daily rhythm. This is what they believe the organization of that circadian timing system is. You've got some sort of photoreceptor. You've got pathways that act in synchrony with each other. That's why they get entrainment. In other words, one after the other. Some sort of processes goes to a centralized location that becomes the pacemaker, with the eye being like the standard, the set point. And from that initial pacemaker, you've got the various slave oscillators, as they say. Again, this is a model. And so that means at different regions of the body, there are additional circadian rhythms, because the circadian rhythm simply doesn't affect your brain, but affects the entire body systems. And you'll see this on the next handout. And finally, those slave oscillators, as they put the slave oscillators, act on the circadian function. Melatonin, if you would take it separately as a, quote, drug-like material, has been shown to act in a circadian pattern. It's synthesized in the body and secreted in the circadian pattern. The pineal gland at the base of the brain is where it's synthesized. Animals, such as yourselves, who are completely blind, and that means no pupillary reflex. That means if you shine a bright light, the pupa doesn't shrink. There's no reflex like that. They retain this entrainment. In other words, that they can be physically blind, and yet they wake up when the sun comes up. And they do that for weeks on end, even though they're completely blind. They can't see. So it must not be the optic nerve that helps set that circadian rhythm. And so they found a direct projection, in other words, a set of nerves separate from the optic nerve that goes to a specific location in the hypothalamus called the suprachiasmatic nucleus, SCN. And so this actually then has, notice what it says here, this retinohypothalamic tract. In other words, that there is some tract starting in your eye, trails all the way back to your hypothalamus back here, and begins that circadian rhythm business. It sets the time points for this circadian rhythm. Maintain that entrainment even when blind. If they go in and wipe out that nucleus, then you lose the circadian rhythms. Let's take a look and see what we're talking about here. graphically on page 10. A couple different things here. You can see here that for a normal individual, there is a variety of functions, that are circadian in rhythm, as it were. Let's see. And I think this is for human individuals. Obviously, during the daylight hours, time of day, it's 0 to 24. Obviously, 24 would be midnight. 12 would be noon. So you have noon of one day, noon of another day, noon of another day, noon, noon. You get the idea there. And you have various y-axes here. Of course, here you have a situation where this is activity. Now, I don't know how they have such a sharp, either you're active or you're not active. Obviously, what that means is the bottom of that thing is sleep, even though you can be tossing and turning in sleep. But so you can see here there is definitely a rhythm, a predictable rhythm in terms of your activity. Not surprisingly, the temperature in your rectum also increases and decreases. Potassium excretion. Now, you wonder why potassium excretion would have anything to do with activity. You would think that you'd have potassium excretion, in other words, that your kidney function would be pretty much constant. That's not the case at all. That it actually slows during sleep, your kidney function does. If you see here, computational speed, and I don't know what they... let's see here. That's rectal temperature. Oh, here's the potassium. Computational speed, sums per minute. You can see here where it's pretty close to maximum near 12 hours or early afternoon. And time estimation, in other words, that they try to tell you what a minute is. That's not it. The accuracy of time estimation also maximizes near daytime and minimizes at night. This is why this is in a little aside. You wonder why in the world modern military attacks are initiated at night is because it's demonstrated that human reflexes, computational speed, which is related to how well you're thinking, time estimation, and so on, are all at a minimum around midnight or 2 o'clock in the morning. Okay. This is why staying up late to do highly technical activity is not that productive. Okay? Because you have a circadian rhythm, whether you like it or not, that enables you to do your best right during the mid part of the day. Yes?
Now, would that mean these soldiers have to be trained to operate at midnight?
Correct.
In the morning,
we're
going to be initiating attack?
Exactly. That means for several weeks before the attack, they get out of that rhythm. And they are intentionally trained to be more active, be more accurate at night. So, I mean, the soldiers, especially, this occurs primarily with air forces, which are especially important to have air dominance and deliver attacks deep within the territory to take out command and control centers. All that's done late at night, in the dark. It's harder to see them as an attacker. The defender can't see nearly as well, physically can't see. They then depend on radar, and radar can be targeted and destroyed. And so there's a lot of positive things for survival and for effectiveness of attack if you can do it, 11 a.m. to 4 a.m., this kind of thing. All right, so this is what happens. This is the entrainment. These are the slave oscillators that you see here. It all begins in the hypothalamus, but all these other systems, the thinking, the and the like the kidneys and so on, which these are all easily measured, that's why they use them, are all linked to that through like what they call slave oscillators. Here's another situation in which this SCN ablation, now the ablation is a fancy word for destruction. So they go in, do surgery on this animal, and they specifically destroy that SCN region. And what they've done here is they have, this is a recording of activity of an albino rat maintained in light-dark cycle. From the top of the record to the arrow, the animal exhibits normal rhythm of activity indicated by dark areas. The record is double-plotted, which means that each line shows the preceding day in the new day to ease evaluation of the record. At the arrow, a bilateral SCN lesion was performed. Activity is randomly distributed thereafter, meaning circadian organization, the rest of activity has been lost. So, this rat is in daylight. I mean, they have him, the light on, light off, light on, light off. And when the light is off, he's active. And when the light is on, he's sleeping. When the light is off, he's active. The dark is active, right? Yeah. So this is the light is off and he's active, light's on and he's not active, and you can see that it's directly related to that rhythm. Okay? But you lose this SCN and he then loses this whole business of being able to have any kind of rhythm to his activity. He's active, he's inactive, he's active, inactive, just loses it completely. And that was the only thing that was destroyed, was that little piece of his brain. All right. Specific actions that alter melatonin levels. I think you should you have quite a bit of this to write in. Synthesis of melatonin is dependent on impulses received from the sympathetic nervous system. Those impulses are those pacemaker signals. Daylight reduces melatonin synthesis in the pineal gland. All right, onset of night increases melatonin synthesis by release of norepinephrine from the sympathetic nervous system. Norepinephrine activates this beta adrenal receptors in the pineal gland, and increases cyclic AMP levels. Increased cyclic AMP stimulates the AANT. Now, I have forgotten what I think that AANT is an enzyme, but I don't remember exactly where. I reviewed this morning, and I missed looking at that particular piece of data, so I'm not sure exactly what the AANT is. It's got to be amino acid neurotransmitters. That could be it, but I'm not sure. I'll look it up. All right, so actions on humans. It's mostly unclear. In other words, if you take excess melatonin, if it affects you significantly, it does to some, others not so much. It does, however, appear to have timing on circadian rhythms. So it does have some sedative and hypnotic effects. We know that it's used to treat disorders related to disturbances of circadian rhythm. Of course, we're talking about jet lag. And some other things. Shift workers, that means people who move between, you know, the night shift and the day shift. It sometimes apparently helps them reset their clocks more quickly. The claims of positive effects by the popular press are exaggerated. It could act as an antioxidant, but whether that has any long-term effect, no one really knows. And finally, actions on animals. Actions on animals. Animals are known. Breeding behavior is dependent on photoperiod. So we can see that certainly this breeding behavior is dependent on photoperiod. You can see this in deer especially. Michigan is just about being overrun by white-tailed deer. Their number of predatory animals that attack deer is limited. And there's plenty of food around, and so there are deer absolutely everywhere. But you're most likely to hit a deer, you're most likely to hit a deer in what time of the year? Anybody know what time of the year you're most likely to hit a deer? I'm sorry? No, you would think so. But no, actually, the fall is the time when there are people hit more deer than any other time. And that's because of this right here. Breeding behavior is dependent on photoperiod. That deer breed in the fall. As the days begin to shorten, that's when they go through their mating behavior. And that's when the bucks lose control of themselves looking for mates. I have direct experience with that. I've hit deer twice living here in Michigan. And the first time was the worst time. I was up in near Camp Asable going south after being at Camp Asable. And I, the highway south many times has a very wide median. Sometimes there's actually forest in between the two medians, two roads in the median. And I'm heading south, and I'm driving along, and out of this one forested median, at full run, comes this buck, and just does not stop. Just, and I hit him. I didn't have a chance to hit my brakes or anything. I hit him at 70 miles an hour. And I was in a van, and he just crunched the front of that van. It just, the battery was broken, and the radiator was busted, and the bumper got pushed into the tire and ripped it apart. And he was hit, of course, as soon as he hit it, boom. He hit it with his butt first, and then whipped into the rest of the end, and with that kind of, and then flew him back into. I was in the outside lane, flew him back in the inside lane, and two other cars ran over him. I mean, he was dead when he hit the ground the first time. I mean, I killed him as soon as he hit him, but then he got hit and ran over a couple more times. And so, I mean, that was the most startled I've ever been in a car, and. To finish the story, it's just weird. You're sitting there all shaken, and your car's a wreck, and you got all these kids in the back. You wonder how in the world you're going to get them home. And these numbskulls come up to me. I call them numbskulls. Come up to me and say, there are other drivers who pull off after the accident and try to help, and they call the police and all this kind of stuff. And one of them comes up and says, do you want the deer? You ran into it. You killed it. You own the deer. Do you want the deer? I go, no. There you go. A good pre-tenderized venison already, huh? Well, I have a comment to make about that. So I said, no, I don't want it. And so they talked. I talked to the cop, and the cop talked to the guy. And so the guy pulled the deer off into the median and gutted it right there. He had to. And I bet you he didn't get as much meat out of that deer as he thought, because when you hit a deer like that, you bust the gut, and all the digestive juices and the chyme and all that stuff get into the intestinal, into the abdominal cavity and ruin the meat almost immediately. So he didn't get very much meat out of that. At any rate, so I have a hard time being mad at you. So did you go see a physician about it? You obviously did.
Oh, yeah.
And what'd they say? It's broken? All right. All right. Well, anyway, I'm glad you're here. Glad you can get out and about. Okay. So that's the deer. So melatonin's both anti-gonadotropic and pro-gonadotropic, so they can't tell exactly what it's supposed to do. If you're going to administer it to change some of the rhythms, you do it best around light to dark transitions. And there are other some things. Let's see here. Now, drugs that act on serotonin chemistry. Original class of serotonin effectors are called tricyclic antidepressants. Tricyclic antidepressants. All right. That's probably not what Xanax and Valium are, but the original class was that. They inhibit both serotonin and norepinephrine uptake. They typically inhibited norepinephrine more than 5-8, more than, oh, there's a class that inhibited norepinephrine more than serotonin. This is desipramine and prototryptyline. And then you got another inhibited serotonin more than norepinephrine. Here, this fluoxetine and paroxetine and sertraline. These three are the very common ones that you hear about. Prozac, I think, or Valium is either the fluoxetine, and so I'm not sure what these other two are. But these are the scientific names, very common antidepressants. And these are all selective serotonin reuptake inhibitors. Another class of drug, and I'll just pull this out so you can write it all down. Another class, of course, you've heard before, is the MAOIs. I typoed the M-A-I-O. It's M-A-O-I. Monoamine oxidase inhibitor. That's that enzyme on the surface of the mitochondria that breaks down serotonin. And all these MAOIs act on OCD, which is obsessive compulsive disorder. They work with the SSRIs. And apparently, norepinephrine doesn't have much to do with OCD. Okay. Generalized anxiety disorder. Now, I want you to simply cross out this, or don't write this down, that FIOGS and MSDS. I searched the web for 15 minutes trying to find out what FIOGS meant. I have no idea where that came from. It was in a book whose reference I've lost. And I don't know what FIOGS is, F-Y-O-G-S. Every time I typed it into Google, it says, do you mean frogs? Because there was a one page of random stuff, obviously typos, and that's it. There was nothing on FIOGS. I went to Wikipedia. There was nothing there. So I went OCD and FIOGS. I went generalized anxiety disorder and FIOGS. I have no idea where this came from. I don't think the people who wrote it down and whom I copied, as it were, know what that means. So I'm going to have to update my update this stuff for next year. Drugs that work to reduce anxiety also act on GABA, gamma-aminobutyric acid. The newer drugs that work on the one of the serotonin receptors as an agonist, that means it stimulates it. Antipsychotic drugs. Now, if you have a psychosis, what are your symptoms if you have a psychosis? Hallucinations, you're no longer connected to reality, you hurt yourself easily, you know, kind of like Brittany, okay? So, she's in a bit of a psychosis, right? No. She's not psychotic. All right. At any rate, so what happens here is these drugs, dopamine receptor antagonists. So if you can block dopamine, and some of these can act on, block dopamine and actually act on a specific subclass of serotonin receptors. LSD, ever hear of LSD? The drug LSD. Anybody? Lysergic. Oh, I don't remember the actual name of it. But that LSD became a very popular drug during the drug-hazed 60s and 70s. You can still get it, but it really it induces almost like a psychotic response, and you get disconnected from reality. Things are distorted. Reality is distorted. Certain things are amplified. Other things are tuned down. But they're not really sure exactly what it's acting on. But it's just, it was one of the early drugs that some advocates for drug-enhanced life seemed to use a lot. Tune in, drop out. Tune in. Tune out. I don't know. There's some phrase that dealt with LSD. And, of course, it's since then been proven to have no positive effects on human beings whatsoever. Okay. Then you have your migraine, and it seems like the serotonin receptors somehow are initiated or stimulated on inflammation response. So they're thinking that maybe certain drugs act on certain subclasses of serotonin, certain subclasses of serotonin receptors, and can help with migraine headaches, nausea and vomiting, certain chemotherapeutic drugs induce nausea. So you've got cancer, they try to help you by killing the cancerous cells, but your quality of life deteriorates dramatically. How many people like the sensation of getting ready to throw up? Huh? You like that? How would you like to have that for hours on end? Perhaps even days or weeks of this nausea feeling. Would you feel good? Would you feel like eating? Would you feel like having a pleasant conversation with your friends? No. You know, and it's not even that you're throwing up. You just feel like you're going to throw up. You get this shaky, you know, just before you throw up, queasy, shaky, feeling crappy. Well, that's what's going on whenever you take some of these anti-cancer drugs. So my advice to you is don't get cancer, okay? All right? It's not as cool as some people say it is. At any rate, so apparently these things cause release of serotonin in inappropriate locations in your body. It could be down in the gut area, which signals your brain, or vice versa. It makes certain nerves kind of raw, And that then induces that nauseating feeling. Antagonists of that particular receptor reduce the effect of increased. A lot of people will take the active ingredient in marijuana. The HTC. And that has a positive effect on reducing nausea. Yes. What is this stand? That what? That's dopamine receptors. Yeah, dopamine. Dopamine. All right. Have you been noticing the ads? If you don't read the paper, I'm sure. Have you been noticing the ads for medical marijuana here in Michigan? We had a constitutional amendment that allowed medical marijuana. Sometimes 6 million people can be wrong. All right, so here's the test. The test is going to be over chapter 11, 12, and part of 13. Okay? I can tell you right now, I do not have time to write a multiple choice test for you.
Yay!
So it's going to be 25 pages of short answer.
Okay.
Really? Really? You don't like my multiple choice questions?
You don't have time to write multiple choices.
Yeah, I can whip out a short
answer.
I can
differently study harder.
Yeah, do you? You don't want to study harder, do you? Yeah, because you actually have to know something. You can't just bloviate. Really? My test questions are completely transparent. No. Okay. All right, so it's going to be short answer, probably 3 pages. Grace is going to have to give it to you. I'm going to be gone last time this semester. I'll be back on Monday. I will be in cranky mood, because I will be driven until 3 o'clock in the morning. We'll have lab Monday afternoon, I hope, if I can pull that together. It's a complicated lab. So we're going to start on doing a Western blot. Have you really? Where'd you do that?
Biology.
What class? Cell and molecular?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And genetics. Well, anybody else in the lab done a Western blot before? Have you done a Western blot before? Well, we'll see if we can get, I'll get an extra set. Can you come Monday afternoon? Oh, you didn't care about the West. I'll get it. Just sit. Grief. Get up and disturb the entire class. Walk around. Trip over people. We already have one person acting like Brittany Foster. We don't need two people acting like this. How rude. Just a continuous rudeness. Okay. Last neurotransmitter. How many of you have allergies? Raise your hand if you have allergies. All right. I would have suspected that Brittany would have allergies. How many of you have boyfriend problems? Yeah, she raises her hand. How many of you hate your biochem teacher? Ah, she raises her hand. Yeah. How many of you? All right, anyway. Who's had the most recent car accident? Then she raises her hand. And, no?
Yes. I don't know. I've
had an accident
in February.
Anybody else get an accident since February? Most recent accident? Yes.
But I was not driving.
Oh, well, it's just your karma, your aura. You're not going to give me a high five? We did. So you hit a car so hard it was flipped? Or your car was flipped?
We hit the side of a mountain.
You hit the side of a mountain? Just how big a car was this? At any rate.
It was an Acura? I don't know. We're driving down to Tennessee and the little mountain passes.
Uh-huh.
Well, they hit in the mountains, and I guess they didn't realize how sharp the turn was.
Yeah.
When they turned it, the car just turned.
Okay. Lost control and whacked in the side of the car. Wow. Impressive. I'm glad you both lived. Three. Yes. Not to make a car accident completely trivial. But at any rate, so those of you who want to have good luck, make sure that you help Brittany as little as you can. No, it's all good. It's all good. Let's take a look. Histamine, one of the most hated compounds in the world. Next, right up there with cholesterol, although we still good cholesterol and bad cholesterol is not actually talking about cholesterol at all. It's talking about what? Was it? The lipids, the lipoproteins, the HDLs and the LDLs, okay? So apparently doctors think patients are too stupid to actually teach them about LDL and HDLs, so they just call it good cholesterol and bad cholesterol, which completely confuses a thinking person, because how can you have a compound that's both good and bad? Well, here you have histamine, a compound which, of course, is both good and bad. It's an important neurotransmitter, but too much of it in the wrong spot gets you some serious physical symptoms that are annoying. Okay, so you can see here that histamine is structurally different than histidine, because it's missing the carbon dioxide, the carboxylic acid part of it, which would be right here off that compound right there. Notice, if you would, that there are three nitrogens on here, three. There is an N-tela, an N-prus, and an N-alpha. Now, that N-alpha, of course, is related to the fact that that's the nitrogen, the amine end of an amino acid. What was the former amino acid? The carboxylic acid would go right there where that CH2 is. And then you've got these two other nitrogens. You can distinguish them because of their connection point, relative closeness of the connection point to that CH2 group. So one that's closer is called pi or prus, and the one that's farther away is called tau or tela. And you need to be able to, on a test, the next test you have, if I give you this structure, I want you to be able to identify the various amines or nitrogens on here. Okay? Now, let's take a look at histamine outside of the central and peripheral nervous system. Histamine, gastric secretion stimulant. What that means here is that some people who are dealing with nighttime acid reflux disease. You've heard of acid reflux disease? This stuff where it just keeps coming up, gets past the sphincter that connects the esophagus to the stomach, goes up. It can erode the esophagus, cause ulcers in it, and eventually if it punctures the esophagus, you can get in very serious problems because you get infections and stuff. Constant irritation from that also leads to tumors, kind of thing. So you don't want that. And so what they do is they try to suppress the amount of acid that's in the stomach. The stomach makes an excess of acid, more than what's needed for digestion. So they can tamp down the amount of acid it produces. One of the medications, or one class of medications, actually acts as an antihistamine, specific for the receptors that deal with the gastric secretion of the acids and enzymes in the stomach. So it actually becomes a sophisticated antihistamine. All right, so histamine is also a response to antigen. Now, this is the pollen. Response of antigens. This is where you got your pollen and your dander and all this kind of stuff. That's certain peptides, certain basic drugs. These act on mast cells and basophils. Also, the inflammation response. So The mast cells and basophils accumulate in around where these antigens initially contact the interior of the body, which is in your nasal passages and your back of your throat, and they stimulate these mast cells and basophils to start secreting materials. You know, basically, that's where you get the watery eyes and the runny nose. It's an inflammation response, so it's all red and irritated and stuff. Histamine also regulates the immune response. There's cardiac stores in heart muscle. Peripheral histamine activates sympathetic and afferent activity. I'm not sure what that means exactly. Any number of things. Let's take a look at the brain, shall we? We know that the brain contains large amounts of histamine. We're not exactly sure why. In other words, that in a generalized point of view, there is a lot of histamine in regions of the brain. What it does, we don't know. It appears to be located near blood vessels. It may have something to do with blood flow or permeability of the materials, the blood-brain barrier, this kind of a thing. Hormonal changes alter the mast cell location. Cells may be involved in nerve degeneration. Diseases, in other words, that these mast cells that secrete excess histamine may have some sort of degenerative effect on nerves. Cerebrovascular endothelial cells release the histamine. The cerebrovascular, there's the brain, the cells lining the vessels, blood vessels of the brain release small amounts of histamine. And again, that may be related to the blood flow. They're not sure. You do not need to write this down. Notice this is X'd out. The location of histamine releasing cells, this kind of information is way too detailed for us. The cells that release, certain types of cells that release lots of histamine apparently have a 2 hertz activity. In other words, that twice a second they release. There's the positive action potential, persistent sodium current. So, in other words, there's something going on in the brain that your brain is continually bathed in this histamine, and its release is timed by these cells, apparently in cycles of 2 every second. Let's take a look at the synthesis of histamine. We have about a minute. Now there's histidine, which is the amino acid. Then you have HDC. Anybody want to hazard? Notice what happens here. You lose carbon dioxide. Guess what you think HDC stands for? Yes, histidine decarboxylase. It's actually listed in the caption here. System metabolism of histamine, solid lines indicate histamine formation. Catabolism in the brain, dashed lines show additional pathways that can occur outside the nervous system. HDC is histidine decarboxylase, HMT, histamine methyltransferase, DAO, diamine oxidase, MAO, monoamine oxidase, aldehyde intermediates shown in brackets have been hypothesized but not isolated. So, you got your histidine, you got your loss of carbon dioxide, bing. In a single step, you move from a common amino acid to a very powerful neurotransmitter just by the loss of carbon dioxide. You know, that just goes to show you the kind of power that small molecules can have. These small molecules, these water-soluble small molecules. In the degradation pathway, SAM adds a methyl group to this. You get this telemethylhistamine, and eventually you get this telemethylimidazole acetic acid. DAO, which is diamine oxidase, gets this intermediate and produces imidazole acetic acid. imidazole, acetic acid, which is a breakdown path, is a breakdown product. So the degradation pathways includes the production of imidazole acetic acid and methylimidazole acetic acid. All right, I think we're done for the day. You've got that. I probably will not have time to get you a review sheet per se for 11, 12, and 13. Let me see what I can do. I know I have some of that. At least I know I have some review for that. Maybe if I can get to it right away, as soon as I get back to my office, maybe I can pull something up, put it on D2L. You guys can go ahead, if you want. We're kind of in the middle of getting everything put back together, but the updating of the reading room is about